Let's read. Our reading this morning comes from the Gospel of Mark, Mark 7. And it's verses 24 to 30. Mark 7, 24 to 30. Now Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know it. Yet he could not keep his presence secret. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an evil spirit came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek, born in Syrian Phoenicia. She begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. "First, let the children eat all they want," he told her. "For it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs." "Yes, Lord," she replied. "But even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Then he told her, "For such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." She went home and found her child lying on the bed, and the demon gone. Dave.
My name is Dave Green, if you've not come across me before. I'm a member here at the church, and I am training to be a lay preacher in the Methodist Church. My day job is a secondary maths teacher, and so that's what I'm doing this week. Today we're going to be looking at this remarkable passage. So, when I came to look at this passage recently, I was struck by what an interesting passage it is. So I'm thinking, well, thank you, Gareth, in a busy week for giving me a Bible passage dealing with chronic demon possession, undertones of sexism and racial tension. Fabulous. Just what we need. But this is a remarkable story, and I hope that you're going to be greatly encouraged by the essential message behind it. We're going to spend about 25 minutes just exploring and digging into this passage, and hopefully that will give us a sense of what it teaches us about God, and what it teaches us about ourselves. I'm going to try and guide you through that. I'm going to, if I use any particular technical terms, I'm going to try and explain myself. If I don't explain myself very well, please talk to me afterwards and ask me any questions you like. But this passage comes at a time when Jesus' ministry is really starting to take off. He's become a phenomenal preacher. And the use of the word phenomenal isn't an understatement. He's doing extraordinary healings. He's doing miraculous works. He's engaging with demonic powers. He's preaching with an authority nobody had seen in that generation at all. And so in the midst of that, we have this story of him leaving the Jewish territories and going to a place called Tyre, which is not a Jewish part of the world at all. In fact, this is the only example that we have of Jesus leaving the Jewish territories in the course of his ministries. He spent the whole time in a comparatively small area. He didn't go to any of the major cities in the Roman world. His influence was actually tied down to Jerusalem, Caesarea, Galilee, those sorts of areas that you read regularly. He didn't go that far from those sorts of areas. So this is a little bit interesting. He's left the Jewish territories for the only time in his ministry. And it seems that he went away to recharge his batteries, to have a bit of a break. He was trying not to tell anybody where he was. And in the course of that, word gets around, and it transpires that a woman whose daughter is possessed by an evil spirit, she comes to ask him for healing. So he doesn't get much of a break at all. And in the midst of this, she is enormously needy. She wants his help. Mark has already given us, if you look at some of the early chapters of Mark, a sense of what demon possession looked like in that context: convulsions, raving, violence, self-harm. The mother must have been extraordinarily distressed. And so she arrives to try and get Jesus to do something about that. And that's what we're going to dig into today. So do have your Bible passages open. Check what I'm saying makes sense. And we'll explore this together. And the first thing I want to make a point about, I suppose, is that Jesus has a break. That's really interesting, isn't it? Being involved in mission means that sometimes you need to have a break. You need to have a time out. And it's ironic, isn't it, a teacher telling you about that? We only work 3/4 of the year, don't we? And don't mention the snow days. When I talk about mission, I'm talking about mission in its broadest sense. So I'm including all of us. All of us are involved in mission. I have a strong sense of ministry when I go into a school and try and teach kids and help them to grow up. You probably have something similar about what you do a lot of the time in your neighborhood, in your workplace, with your families. It might be paid, it might not be paid. I'm a strong believer that the Bible brings us all to a place where we're involved in mission. And that doesn't necessarily mean we're paid for that mission, but we're all reaching out to a world with the gospel. And that means that sometimes we're communicating the gospel explicitly, and sometimes we're living it out. And in the context of that, it can become quite tough and pressurized, can't it? Many of us will feel stress and pressure. Employers, if you're in paid work, make increasing demands on your time. I started a new job in September as head of maths in a failing school. And I learnt that 5 out of 6 of my maths team were off with stress at some point last year. So, even in teaching, there's all sorts of pressure. And so, I want to say that it's important for us to sometimes have a break and listen to what our bodies and our emotional state are saying about the fact that we might need to have a time out, a time of recovery, a time to be restored. But I think on top of the idea of a break and a kind of holiday and a bit of a time out, such times are also a useful time to try and get a perspective on our mission. Because one of the dangers of mission is it can become a bit of an idol, can't it? I was reading a really interesting book a couple of years ago called Counterfeit Gods by a man called Tim Keller. And he talks about what is an idol. An idol is anything more important to you than God. Anything that absorbs your heart and imagination more than God. Anything you seek to give you what only God can give. A counterfeit God is anything so central and essential to your life that should you lose it, your life would feel hardly worth living. An idol is has such a controlling position in your heart that you can spend most of your passion and energy, your emotional and financial resources on it without a second thought. The true God of your heart is what your thoughts effortlessly go to when there is nothing else demanding your attention. What do you enjoy daydreaming about? What occupies your mind when you have nothing else to think about? Idolatry is not just a failure to obey God, it is the setting of the whole heart on something besides God. So sometimes we need a break to try and get a perspective on what we're doing. So it's important for us to have those times when we get physically restored, and also it's important for us to spend some time thinking about the relative importance of what we're spending our time doing and making sure that it isn't taking the place of God. But having thought about that, let's move on to this next part where we find this conversation with this determined woman, this extraordinary woman, and Jesus' response, which seems so harsh, doesn't it? It seems so brutal, it seems so rude, and I want to dig around a little bit and try and get what's going on in this kind of conversation. Because on the face of it, it looks very much like it's a racial slur. She's a Gentile, he's a Jew. This reference to dogs. I want to say that I believe that the Bible has racial integration in its DNA. I believe that the message of the early church was very much one of reconciling nations and bringing them together. I was reading about Billy Graham recently and in his obituaries. And one of the things that was interesting was a reflection that he had on regrets about his life, which is extraordinary considering what he achieved. But one of the things that he regretted was not getting more involved in the civil rights movement of the 60s. In an interview in 2005, he said he wished he'd fought for civil rights more forcibly. In particular, Billy Graham lamented not joining Martin Luther King and other pastors at voting rights marches in Selma, Alabama in 1965. He said, "I think I made a mistake when I didn't go to Selma. I would like to have done more." And I think it's that recognition that at the heart of the Bible and the gospel message, there is no Greek and Jew, male or female. That those boundaries, those barriers have been broken down. And if you want a really, really good example of that, in Acts 13, there is a description of the church, which is absolutely wonderful, where you get a sense of how diverse the New Testament church was, and how the Christians had taken that gospel message and realized that it meant that those boundaries between races and cultures, they were not important. They were secondary to the gospel. So in the early church, you have this leadership structure, which involves Barnabas the Levite. He was from a Greek society. He was Jewish originally, but he was from the island of Cyprus. And then there was Simeon, who was from African, who had become a Jew and then a convert. Lucius of Cyrene had come from the Greek world. Manion had grown up in the court of Herod the Tetrarch. And then there was Saul the evangelist. And you had this bunch of people who ordinarily would never have met together but for the sake of the gospel. Those racial boundaries have been broken down. And Antioch itself was really, really interesting. Because when Seleucus Nicator, who was the creator of the city of Antioch, started to build it in the first place, he realized that there was going to be a lot of different racial groups together. And so his response to that problem was to build loads of walls. And so each community was like a walled community all to itself. And that's how Antioch was built up. And so you had ghettos of different ethnic groups. And the walls protected those groups from other groups. And what you find is that Acts, there's this kind of one-liner in Acts where it says, in Antioch, the followers of Jesus were first called Christians. And you can pass over that verse, but what's going on there is that the people of Antioch, they noticed that the Christians were a right mix of people. And they didn't have a name for them anymore. They couldn't call them Greeks, they couldn't call them Jews, they couldn't call them Africans. They didn't have a name for anymore because this community, it transcended all of these groups. And so they had to come up with a brand new name. And what are we going to call these people? They follow Jesus Christ. We can call them Christians. And that was the reason why they had this whole naming thing in the first place. So the New Testament is full of examples of how the gospel breaks down racial barriers. So what was Jesus saying then? What was this about? And one of the problems of reading passages is you don't get tone, and it's easy to get communication breakdowns when you're just looking at something that's written. I've got a friend of mine, Peter. He sent a text message to his wife a few years ago. It was in the days of those Nokia phones, you know, with the predictive texts. Yes. Yes. What he meant to say was, "I'm leaving for home." Last word was changed to "good." Little bit awkward when he got back that evening. Sometimes communication breaks down. And one of the things that we've got to do with this passage is to dig around and find out a little bit more about context. So if you look at the word for dog in this context, it actually doesn't mean the word that was generally used for racial slurs. It's a slightly different word. It refers to small dogs. And I want to paint a picture for you. because I think this is what Jesus has in mind. I think he's telling like a mini parable. And a parable, don't overthink parables. They generally have one major thing that they're trying to say. So this is what's going on. My father-in-law, he has a wonderful little house. It's a converted barn near Bredsall Priory. And he's got two Jack Russells. And so when we go around for a meal, we have a meal together. And guess what happens at the end of the meal? The Jack Russells eat what we've not eaten. And so they polish off anything that's any that my fussy kid eaters have not destroyed at that point. And Jesus is talking about priorities at this point. He's talking about an order of timing. He has a very, very specific mission. It was deliberately focused around the Jewish regions. He wasn't trying to reach lots of people outside of the Jewish faith. And so what he's trying to say to the woman, and we've got no idea if he did it with a twinkle in his eye, we don't get tone, we don't get humour very easily, but he is saying, there's an order to what I'm trying to do here. And I've got to prioritise, and I'm prioritising the Jewish nation. And so it isn't a massive insult. What he's trying to do in a small parable is talk about priorities. But in the context of that, do you hear the hint as well? That ultimately there will be a time when people outside the Jewish nation will have access to the gospel. And this is really important because Mark is dropping hints through his gospel that when the gospel starts to explode in Acts, it will go well beyond the boundaries of where Jesus has operated. And so one of the things about this passage, ironically, is that it's actually conveying the fact that the gospel is ultimately going to go beyond Jewish boundaries, that those racial boundaries are going to be dropped down. They're going to be overcome. So what does the woman respond to? And it's a really remarkable thing, this, in terms of her determination and her wit. Somebody once said, when it comes to adversity, there are three types of people. Heroes, cowards, and parents. If you're a parent, you've probably got a bit of an idea of what I'm talking about. I was on a holiday trip with my family, and we were doing some bodyboarding in Cornwall. And if you've been bodyboarding in Cornwall, you have a flag system, because they have extraordinarily powerful riptides. And you have to bodyboard within the flags, because otherwise you get sucked out to sea by the currents. And my daughter, who continues to be way too overconfident at times, she went out with a bodyboard, and then suddenly I looked across and I realized that she was outside of the flags. And so without a second thought, I went out and I got into the water where she was, and already she couldn't hit the bottom. So she was floating, and she was floating outwards. By the time I got to her, I was floating outwards. So both of us had got caught in the riptide. Now, eventually the story had a happy ending and we got out of the water. Was I thinking about the worries and the risks of that situation? Of course not. If you're a parent, you know exactly what was going on in my head at the time. All I'm thinking about is my child, and I want to get there, and I want to make sure she's safe. And that's what's going on with this woman. She is not going to be deterred. She's the mother of a child. Balanced theological responses which don't change the situation are not going to work for her. She accepts everything that Jesus says, but she adds her own twist to the story, the picture that he has made. The little dogs get the crumbs. It doesn't have to be one or the other today. And it's clear from Matthew's accounts that her response absolutely delighted Jesus. There's a parallel account in Matthew. You don't get it quite so much in the sense of Mark. And he goes on to heal the daughter. There's a wonderful ending. And I just want to reflect for a few moments on that whole sense of what delights God. What delights God? And what was it about this woman's response which really Jesus found quite extraordinary? You know, you get this a few times in the New Testament where Jesus is just surprised, which is extraordinary, isn't it? He's just surprised. The centurion who has the faith that Jesus is just going to heal his servant. He's just caught out by this faith and absolutely delighted about it. So what is it about this woman that stops Jesus in his track and causes him to act and intervene in her life? Well, I think that there's a couple of things that can stop us from being in the situation she is in. And they're kind of polar opposites. Firstly, sometimes we overestimate our own abilities and our capacity and feel very little need for God. So we don't approach God or Jesus in the way this woman does because we're pretty competent, successful people. We don't get into trouble. We're nice. And that kind of sense of our own ability stops us realizing how much we need God. We have a little bit of a superiority complex at that point. And this woman didn't have that, did she? She knew that she got nowhere else to go. Nobody else was going to sort out this problem. And the other danger is that we are cripplingly aware of our failings and weaknesses. It's painful. It's forever before us. And we're so aware of them that we don't believe God can overcome those failings. And again, this woman avoids that completely. She is utterly confident that Jesus is going to sort this out. She knows that he has the ability to cure her daughter of this appalling situation she's in. Both positions lack the faith of the woman in the story. And it's interesting that this story is kind of echoed down the years. Because when Thomas Cranmer was writing the Book of Common Prayer, he wrote these words, and see if you can hear the echoes of the story of this woman. This is a prayer that many of you will have heard before. It's one that is often used in communion services. We do not presume to come to this thy table, O merciful Lord, trusting in our own righteousness. That's a sense of our inadequacy. But in thy manifold and great mercies, God's capacity. We be not worthy so much as to gather up the crumbs under thy table. But thou art the same Lord, whose property is always to have mercy. Grant us therefore, gracious Lord, so to eat the flesh of thy dear Son, Jesus Christ, and to drink his blood in these holy mysteries, that we may continually dwell in him and he in us, that our sinful bodies may be made clean by his body and our souls washed through his most precious blood. I don't know what you're facing this week. If it's anything like me, it'll be difficult situations, awkward conversations, friends and relatives struggling with health. I guess many of us are in those kind of situations. I want to invite you in a few moments to bring those things to God in prayer with a mindset that is like this woman, that recognizes how much we need God and how little we can contribute, but also his capacity to deal with our situation. Amen.